Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hi, folks. I hope you are all well. It's Patrick at History Chappy on behalf of the editorial team. Shout out to Elliot and Connell, wherever you are with the Versus History editors. But today, the most important person is Peter Shea, and he is the co-editor of In the Arena. And Peter, I don't want to talk too much about you because you can do it for yourself, but you're a writer editor and you've been a teacher for over 25 years and you are a self-proclaimed history geek. And you've written a book, In the Arena, all about presidential candidates, but the losing one. So I won't go any further, Peter. Over to you. Could you tell us a little bit about you, your background, and your wonderful book?
Certainly. I've always been an avid reader of history, and by pure accident, I became an English major when I should have been a history major in college. But even when I was in graduate school for English, I found myself writing for an encyclopedia of history. And so I kept my interest, and my colleague Tom Mady and I went to college together in the 80s. And Tom is a photographer, and we worked together on a book about 25 years ago called Great Chicago Stories, which is about stories of prominent people from Chicago. And several years ago, Tom called me up and mentioned that he noticed the monument to Stephen Douglas, who lost the 1860 election to Abraham Lincoln. There's a prominent monument to him, to Stephen Douglas, in Chicago. And Tom said, it's an interesting thing, a monument to someone who didn't become president. He said, why don't we do a book about that? There won't be any competition. And I said, that's a good idea. There won't be any competition. So let's go ahead and do the book. You know. And besides that, the stories of the people who have won have been told and retold many times, but no one's really thrown a light, for the most part, on the individuals who ran and lost. Some of them were prominent, are still prominent historically. Some of them were only prominent in the days in which they lived, but they were all interesting people because otherwise they probably would never have gotten the nominations of the party. So we thought it was a good story to tell.
No, it certainly is. Absolutely fascinating one. As a student of American history myself and American politics, I know a pretty big deal about the winning candidates, not so much about the losing ones, especially those further back in the chronological trajectory of history. So that's what your book's all about. I think you've covered that. So let's just jump straight into the actual beef of the history then. So let's start with some counterfactual history. What may history have looked like if just one, and that's one of your choice, Peter, of America's losing candidates, what would history have looked like if just one of those candidates had actually made it to the Oval Office and Washington? Pick whichever one you want and entertain us for a while.
Well, you know, there are so many ones that were candidates at pivotal moments. And you can even go to the start. If Aaron Burr had become a president, it would have been an interesting curve in American history. He was a very talented man, brilliant, accomplished man, but a man who had some serious character flaws. He was more imbued with personal ambition than I think he was pure patriotism, which is one of the things that separated him from a few of the other candidates. They were all very ambitious people, even the ones we remember and celebrate. But for the most part, they kept their personal ambition in check in the interest of the country, which is one of the reasons why we still venerate them. Burr was more of a simple opportunist. He just saw the pathward for himself. And I think those character flaws would have impacted the direction of America early in its history. We've had characters like that, but later on, in the early days, we had at least a good buffer of a few decades where we had people who really were committed to the idea of public service. So I think right there is a good example. And of course, Burr in the past few years has enjoyed an ironic posthumous fame as the antagonist of the musical Hamilton.
Yeah. Talk less, smile more. I think that's his favorite line in that play.
Yeah, yeah. We remark upon the fact that the statue of Burr in New York has him with his pistol. It's the only statue I've seen to a politician which emphasized their violent nature. Many of them did, of course, have violent natures, but it wasn't reflected in the statue. So I think that particular monument is fascinating because it really does show an aspect of the man that in the end overshadowed all the other qualities that he had. And he had many positive qualities, and he had a brilliant start in life. He just went down a dark road.
Well, thank you very much for that. It's good to put some extra context behind the man that I've seen in Hamilton, the musical, a good three times. Thank you very much. Okay, let's move on to then Black presidential candidates from Jesse Jackson to Shirley Chisholm. There's been a good few of them, but they've often been overlooked in history, I'm sure you would agree. And what could you share with us about those candidates? Because I know they're mentioned in your book, In the Arena. So over to you, Peter.
I think in the case of Jackson and Chisholm were real pioneers. I mean, they were the kind of individuals, again, who went in, as we say, into the arena and knew that the chances of them winning were not great, but they did it anyway. And that they really captured the spirit of what we try to discuss in the preface of the book, because the title In the Arena comes from a speech by Teddy Roosevelt. And the theme of Roosevelt's speech is that a republic really needs citizens who are not only public service minded, but it needs a critical mass of people who are willing to take risks to change things and do things, even if they're going to lose and lose publicly. And, you know, in the United States, we have this odd culture where we celebrate business failure, but political failure leaves you with a kind of stain on your reputation. But you've done something on behalf of the public. And if you failed, you failed. And Chisholm and Jackson both knew that the odds against them were tremendous, but they wanted to make a statement by their campaigns to say, we are part of this country and people like us should be represented at the highest office. So I think they held a special place of honor in terms of candidates who went for the presidency.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. I've just got to dig a little deeper on that. Why did they lose? Why did Jackson or Chisholm actually lose? There'll be people asking that. They'll, I'm sure, support, you know, the fact they should be remembered and they should be chronicled and included in the canon of history. But what led to them not being successful in the first place? Obviously, it'll be different depending on the candidates. But is there anything you could point to for either candidate or any of the others?
Well, I'll start with Chisholm. Although we don't really, because Chisholm and Jackson both ran, but they didn't get to they didn't receive the nominations of the party, but they were candidates early on. So we don't give them as much time. We don't give them the time we give it to the people who get the nomination. So I just wanted to clarify that. But in answer to your question, Chisholm had obviously two obstacles in her path. One, she was a woman, and the second, she was Black in a country whose major political leaders were all white male. And that was simply the established way of things. And again, owing to our sort of caste-based thinking, she was a real outlier. But by simply saying, a person like me can be a candidate and should be a candidate, she helps change the conversation. The other thing was that Chisholm was, while a well-known politician in her area, she wasn't as big a national figure as others. That it was still a time when to be a serious contender for the presidency, you had to have gotten a lot of visibility on national issues. And while there are often candidacies for president from people who serve as governors or House representatives, the best time to position, if you've had opportunity to really get major exposure. And even the candidates who lost in the second half of the 20th century were people who were well known to the public because they knew how to build their brand. And in the case of Jackson, in a sense, he's picking up the torch passed from Chisholm for a non-white candidate. He was a nationally known figure, very well known, but he had no experience as a working politician. And I would say back in those days, at least, there was still a reservation on the part of Americans to make someone chief executive who hadn't actually worked up through government ranks. So obviously that's changed, but that was certainly an issue then. But his candidacy, I recall, really helped galvanize his party. And I recall his concession speech when he at the Democratic nomination, when he indicated that he was not going to get the nomination. It was still one of the most moving speeches of that particular convention that people experienced. And I can still recall watching on television and seeing people crying.
Thank you very much, Peter. Okay, changing tack somewhat controversial question, potentially, about controversial national statues. So let's go for it. Why is the conversation surrounding the removal of national statues in America and monuments now such an important contemporary issue?
That's a great question, because when we began, nobody cared, unless you were a pigeon. And then in the past couple of years, and I think owing to social media and people posting monuments, people realized they reawakened to the way in which public monuments express a national narrative, an approved national narrative. And at a time when there's a lot of contention around whose narrative we should be following as a country, the monuments were seen as foot soldiers in one narrative or another. And therefore, in order to advance the narrative you believed in, you either had to support it or rally for its removal. And in some cases, it was an easy call. I mean, I've always thought that the Confederate monuments were problematic. They would often been created in the last 100 years or 150 years as a unifying thing to celebrate the courage of the losing side. So as is to say, no hard feelings. The problem, of course, is you can't separate the Confederate soldiers or politicians from the Confederate movement itself, which was deeply embedded in the preservation of slavery. And I think we simply arrived at a point when we realized how ridiculous it was to say that we are an inclusive country at the same time celebrating people whose vision was decidedly non-inclusive. So we started with the low-level Confederates, and then we finally worked our way up to removing statues of General Lee, which is a big deal in my lifetime, because if there was any figure from that era, on the Confederate era, that was considered untouchable, it would be Robert E. Lee. So when Lee came down, all bets were off. Nobody was safe. I'm particularly curious about the Confederate monument carved into Stone Mountain. I don't know how you're going to, if anyone's gone after that one, it's a little bit difficult because it is actually carved in the side of the mountain.
Indeed, it is.
Yeah, the Confederate movement. But the very fact that there's a larger consensus around the importance of removing those statues, I think is a good thing. I don't think we're ambivalent about that anymore. There are other figures whose stories, I think, and whose personal histories require some more thoughtful and nuanced approach. And I think in some cases, there's been too much of a rush to take down those monuments or replace them. And I think something similar has happened in the past couple of years in Britain as well. There are a number of monuments or buildings named after prominent Britons whose value system would not be universally, who would not be acceptable today, like David Hume, for example. But again, you have to judge some people in the context of their times and weigh it against their other accomplishments and whether or not they actually actively advocated for oppressive societies. With Confederates, that's an easy call. With other public figures, not so much. So I hope we get around to, again, a more nuanced conversation around the monuments, but I am glad that we're having it, at least.
Thank you very much, Pete. Okay, the final question from us. The 1988 presidential candidate, Michael Dukakis, has written the foreword for your book, In the Arena. What does he reveal about the experience of running for president and of losing in that race? Over to you.
Well, he reveals the not surprising fact that it's not fun to lose as a president.
Of course. That goes without saying, I guess.
That goes without saying. However, in the case of Dukakis, interestingly enough, he had been prepared because early in his career, he had run for governor of Massachusetts. He had succeeded and had, objectively speaking, a very successful tenure. And he was confident that he was going to get elected to a second term. And he wasn't, and he was shocked. And it was an incredibly emotionally painful thing for him because he felt, and many people felt, he had done a good job. But the problem was for him, he was kind of aloof. He didn't really connect with the public. He was more of a technocrat and a much more personable, if less administratively capable politician came and defeated him. And so Dukakis spent a couple of years in academia really kind of mulling over these things, absorbing them, learning the lessons, and then coming back re-campaigning for governor and winning and having an even more successful other term as governor. So I think better than most of the candidates, Dukakis was psychologically prepared for the experience of losing because he had felt he had a crucible moment early in his career. And I think he handled it with tremendous grace. Other candidates, I think, took longer to process. I certainly think that was true for Al Gore and for Hillary Clinton when they lost. But it shows the courage of the people who do it, because obviously if you put all your energy into it and you lose, it's such a conspicuous loss. Everybody remembers you as the person who lost the presidency, and it takes courage to even attempt that.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And the fact it's a job for one and one only at one time means there's going to be losers, right? So right. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Well, Peter, let's conclude by just sort of talking about your book then. Where can we get it? When did it come out? Who's it published by? And where can we get a hold of it?
Well, it's published by Trope.com, which is a publishing company out of Chicago. It's TROPE.com. And you can get it directly from their website, or you can get it through Amazon. Amazon is another source. I recommend trying to go through the Trope site first, but it's available in both places. And Trope has been a company for publishing books, typically books of photography and culture. And they have a wonderful catalog of other books available as well. So if you visit their site, I think you can see not only my book and Tom's book, but a bunch of other wonderful books that people might want to consider buying.
Lovely jubbly. So Trope will be very happy with you for that, Peter. And if people want to get in touch with you, if they want to ask any questions, if they disagree with something you've written, or they just want to get engaged with some conversation, or I'll ask some questions, is there any way they can get hold of you, either via social media? Are you on any of those platforms?
I'm on LinkedIn.
There you go.
So they can certainly go for me to there and find me. And of course, if they want to direct any inquiries to Trope directly through their website, I'm sure Trope would be happy to pass them on to me.
There you go. Well dodged. All right. Well, thank you so much, Peter, on behalf of myself, the editors, Versus History. We love history. That's why we do the podcast. That's why people listen. And thank you so much for sparing the time to come to talk to us all about your book, In the Arena and the Losing Presidential Candidates. This will be our 140th podcast episode. So we were delighted to have you join us for that. And we thank you for your time. Much appreciated. And all the best for the book.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. And 140 is my lucky number. So there you go.
All right, then, Peter. All the best.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.